Hi, thank you. Let me ask, I started with these questions before, but I'd like to get an idea of how many of you are worried about the current economy and if you're going to have a job or make enough money to make ends meet? Okay. And how many of you are currently out of work or not making enough to make ends meet? Okay. And how many of you are worried about ecological collapse on the planet, or in the future? Okay. Yeah, that's a good aware crowd here. My book shows you how to party like it's 1929. Sort of things like how to make moonshine, grow tons of food in a small area, and tan a deer hide, and heal yourself of serious diseases if medicines are either not available or the regular high-tech medicines maybe aren't working. So back in 1929, in my grandparents' era, in the small communities around this country, there was somebody in the community that knew how to make, grow, or fabricate pretty much everything that was needed for a decent standard of living. And nowadays, most of those skills have been shipped offshore. You know, our shoes come from China and the Philippines or Indonesia. Our clothing is mostly made somewhere else. And the foundries that used to be part of most communities in this country to cast metal and fabricate metal, those have pretty much disappeared too all across the country. So now, could you get by like your grandparents did back in 1929 when their jobs and their savings evaporated? That's a good question to ask yourself. I think 10 years ago, there's very few of us who thought that economic collapse in America was really a potential reality. And I think now there's very few of us who don't believe that there's a good, strong possibility of an out-and-out collapse. Back in the Great Depression time, there were shanty towns that sprung up all across America when people lost their businesses and their homes to foreclosure. And this is a scene right now in Sacramento, the capital of California. It was became famous when a reporter for Oprah went into the new tent city happening in Sacramento and started interviewing people. Now, it's quite a shock because, in America, we're used to seeing homeless people as being kind of indigent people, mostly with an alcohol or drug or some kind of mental problem. And when I saw the people being interviewed on Oprah, I saw hardworking carpenters and contractors. I saw people who've been real estate salespeople, people who've been professionals all of their life, who never imagined that one day they would be homeless and that they would be on the streets. Because these were people who have worked hard all their life, who've maintained jobs, who've been professionals, and all of a sudden, they'd struggled as hard as they could, they maxed out their credit cards to keep their payments going, and then suddenly, like myself, while I was writing the latest edition of the book, it was a real struggle. Because when I was writing this edition, the new edition of the book, I took like another year of labor to do the second edition, and I had my credit cards, I had a lot of credit, and I was kind of strung out, but I looked at it and said, well, okay, I got another $20,000 on my credit cards, so I can just write some credit card checks while I'm writing my book, and no problem. Well, on Saturday, I called, went online to check on my bank account, and I found out all of a sudden that I'm bouncing checks like crazy. I just bounced like 8 checks, and I call my bank and say, well, what's the story? I got $20,000 in credit. How can I be bouncing checks? I've got an overdraft line with another $9,000 on it. They said, well, Mr. Stein, didn't you get our letter? I said, well, what letter? They said, oh, well, we reevaluated. We saw that you've been using your credit line and writing credit card checks, so we reevaluated. We decided that your debt-to-income ratio is too high, so we slashed your credit, so you don't have any more credit. And I said, well, when did you mail this letter? And this is Saturday morning at 9 o'clock. Oh, we mailed it Friday afternoon at 3. And it's like, well, wait, I was counting on this credit. to run my business, you know, to keep my bills paid while I'm writing the second edition of my book. So, you know, this is happening all across America. This is not just me. This is happening to all kinds of people, and I know firsthand. So it was tough, you know. I mean, I ended up being behind, and my wife's freaking out because I'm getting automated calls 10 times a day saying, you know, you're behind on your credit card payment, you're behind on this payment, you're behind on that payment. And then the bank says, oh, Mr. Stein, now your credit's ruined because we slashed your credit and bounced all these cards. So we're going to take your credit rates, which were 9% and 10%, and we're going to give you 25 to 30%. How does that sound? You know, it's like, oh, you're having troubles making your payments at 9%? Well, you shouldn't have any problem at 30% now, right? So anyway, hopefully, you know, most of us, or many of us in this country, are just a few paychecks away from being broke. It was quite shattering, or quite frightening, to see that Oprah special, and to see that one of the few businesses that's doing really well in Sacramento was a guy who had 3 employees 3 years ago, and now he has 60 employees. And what he does is he's hired by the banks to go to houses and clean them out, because they found that they can't wait for the Goodwills to come and take all of this stuff. People who've got no money, they got no place, they got no place to put their, store their stuff. And, you know, they're moving out of a house, they're moving into a tent or a room in an apartment or a little teeny hotel. So they're leaving whole households full of big screen TVs, computers, you know, kitchens filled with pots and pans and dishes, and there's no charity organizations with enough time on their hand to go and clean these out. So they, this guy that used to have 3 employees now has 60 employees, and he sends a crew out with a dumpster, and in 3 hours' time, everything in a house, all this brand new cool stuff they bought on credit in the last few years, is thrown in the dumpster and hauled off to the landfill. So this is our modern America. Now, here's some important lessons from around the world. The Soviet Union, North Korea, and Cuba, these are countries that have gone through financial collapses already. Now, the Soviet collapse, Christmas of 1991. Many people, me included, thought that the reason the Soviet Union collapsed was because of the arms race. You know, Reagan, it's like Reagan was the big hero because, you know, we did the arms race and we beat the Soviets out and they collapsed because they couldn't keep up with us. Well, there's a really interesting book by Dmitry Orlov called Reinventing Collapse, and he grew up in the Soviet Union and emigrated to the America just before the collapse and went back, was going back and forth both before, during, and after the collapse. And it turned out that what really caused the Soviet Union collapse was a cash crunch. You see, the Soviet Union bought all of their stuff in the world market mostly with exporting oil. See, people think that like Saudi Arabia is the biggest oil producer in the world. Well, they're wrong. The number one oil producing country in the world is the Soviet Union. Now, the Soviet Union exports less than Saudi Arabia because they are a much bigger country and they use more of the oil themselves. But the number one producer in the world of oil today is and has been the Soviet Union. So what happened, though, is that they were a very inefficient economy, poorly run, inefficient state-run economy, and it turned out that their oil, you know, their oil, national oil company was not more, any more efficiently run than the rest of this country. So when the Soviet, when the price of oil crashed in the 1980s, it ended up costing the Soviet Union as much money to make the oil as they could sell it for. So all of the money that they'd been relying on, the income off of that they'd been relying on to run their government went away, and they just, the government bankrupted and collapsed. So now what happens there? Well, all of a sudden their rubles were worthless for more than like fire starter. So people got by in the Soviet Union based on barter and trade in the black market. Now, the Soviet Union, when it collapsed, in some ways they were, they, you know, it's much easier on them than it would be for us in America if they collapsed. Because think about it. When the Soviet Union collapsed, the lights stayed on, the water kept on running, the heat stayed on in the buildings. They were, you know, people weren't kicked out of their buildings because they were state-run apartment houses and complexes. It was state-run mass transit. So the trains and the buses still ran, even though the country was bankrupt. It was still, you know, things were still running. It was like no money and it was tough, but things were still running. Plus, the people in that country were used to supplementing, you know, it was like nothing worked well in the country. So they all had their kitchen gardens and they all planted food in the backyard, and they had, you know, if they had a south-facing windows in their apartments, they were growing vegetables inside their apartments. So the people were used to things not working very well. So when it collapsed, you know, the main things they had to have for life to go on still worked. Now in America, think about it. When Enron collapsed, when it went bankrupt, the next day, the buildings were boarded up and chained. No one could get anything. When MCI, you know, how many of us had an MCI phone card? I had one, you know, probably bunches of you did. When MCI went bankrupt the next day, it was toast, it was over. People went to their jobs, doors were boarded up, paychecks stopped, everything just stopped like that. When you stop paying the bank here, it's not like the Soviet Union where they say, don't worry, you know. Yeah, you can live there. The power will stay on, the heat will stay on, the water will stay on. You know, it's not like that in this country. So, anyway, that's one example of collapse. North Korea. Now, when the Soviet Union went down, there was a ripple effect. It took down two other economies that were dependent on it. I mean, more than the two, but the two big ones that come to mind is North Korea and Cuba. See, North Korea was getting their oil and their coal and a lot of their parts, spare parts and things that kept their country going from the Soviet Union. So when the Soviet Union came in 1991 and said, you know, it's over. We're closing our doors and we're going to split up in a bunch of countries and the Soviet Union's over. Well, you know, those countries that were kind of self-sufficient were doing sort of okay. But North Korea and Cuba, all of a sudden, their meal ticket went away. So North Korea is an example of how not to do collapse. What happened there is when the fuel stopped running, the gas stopped running, you know, that was propping up Jim Jong-il, is that how you pronounce it? Kim Jong-il, right. Sorry, excuse me. So what they did then is he said, okay, all of a sudden our big meal ticket's gone, so all of our food and all of our medicine, well, if you're in the government or if you're in the military, then you get food and you get medicine, and if you're not, well, I don't care about you. So many millions of people starved to death, and a lot of the country got defoliated because people were just, they went to the hills and they were eating bark off the trees. You can peel the bark and eat the green layer, which if the Donner Party had known how to do that, they wouldn't have resorted to Aunt May. I live a few miles away from where the Donner Party had their infamous winter where they resorted to cannibalism. So that always sticks out in my mind. But, you know, North Korea is an example of a country that did not manage collapse very well. And if you were part of the in crowd, you got fed and you got medicine, you got clothing. And if you weren't, then, you know, you fended for yourself. And many people who knew what to do would go to the mountains and the hills and they ate edible plants and roots and things like that. But even that got scavenged down pretty badly in short order. Now, Cuba did a little better with collapse. When the Soviet Union meal ticket dried up for Cuba, all of a sudden their spare parts went away, their gasoline supply and coal supply went away. They started having major blackouts. They had no more pesticides coming into the country for their agriculture. So what they did was they went to organic, low-tech agriculture. They went to homeopathy and natural healing. The average Cuban lost 25 pounds of weight and consumed roughly 60% of the calories post-Soviet collapse that they had before. But life went on. Of course, Cuba is a tropical climate, so it's a little more benign and outside of the occasional hurricane. It's a much more gentler climate than North Korea. They don't have rough winters, so that made it easier on them in collapse. Now, one thing to ask yourself, okay, what matters most when the money is gone? Well, in the Great Depression, community and family were extremely important. People banded together. In fact, in some communities, when things got bad with foreclosures, whenever there'd be a new farm foreclosure, then all the neighbors would come over with their shotguns, and when the bank or, you know, the local cops would show up to try and take the farm, it was the community getting together that saved that local farm and kept them from getting kicked out. So that happened off and on across the country, and then eventually the government realized it was such a huge problem that they put a moratorium on foreclosures. But huge numbers of people lost their farms and their homes in what's called the greatest land grab in history before the government finally said, we got to do something about this. So there were individuals who had cash reserves who became extremely wealthy during the Great Depression because they took advantage of all of those people who had no money and just scooped up everything. Now, other things that matter, food. When I was married, my mother-in-law is Dutch Indonesian, went through the Indonesian Revolution in World War II. And one of her best buddies had a little bag of jewels, rubies and emeralds and diamonds that she brought with her from Indonesia. And see, they lived on a farm and they had bags of rice. And people would trade jewels and golds and silver for a bag of rice. So, you know, most of us aren't wealthy enough to have big bags of jewels and gold and silver, but having some stores of valuable things like food and Bic lighters, toilet paper, you know, things that we think that are so cheap commodities today, they can become valuable barter kinds of things in a world where there's money that's not worth anything. And you may say that that's never going to happen, but, you know, it happened in Russia, it happened in Korea, you know, it's happened in Argentina, it's happened in a lot of places in the world, and it could happen here in America. I'm not saying to be paranoid, but let me give you a little story. People ask me, like, why did you write this book? And they say, you know, have you always been a survivalist? Have you always been into this stuff? And I'll say, no. I'm an engineer. I have a Bachelor of Science in Mechanical Engineering from MIT. I grew up hunting and fishing in Vermont. My parents were outdoor enthusiasts. I grew up in the backcountry. So I have some of the skill set that I teach in this book, but certainly not all of it. But back in 1997, at that time it had been a 20-year practice of daily prayer and meditation. And I was just meditating in my normal meditation in the morning, and I asked for guidance and inspiration. And I had a bomb dropped in my lap that morning. I got, you know, just a generic request. It's not like I normally see visions and hear voices or, you know, I'm an MIT guy. I'm an engineer. I'm a geek, okay? Though I used to be a long-haired geek, now I'm a no-haired geek, but I'm still a geek. So I asked for guidance and inspiration, and I got a storyboard outline for my book dumped into my head instantaneously. I had roughly 30 pictures. Just like if you see, like, artists make renderings when they're outlining the scenes of a movie, and they kind of do a picture for each scene of the movie. Well, I had that dumped in my head with pictures for the scenes of my book. My first thought was, like, no way. I can't possibly do this book. This is a huge project. And I don't know all this stuff. And the little voice in my head, you know, Jesus calls it the still small voice. It's not real loud. It said, well, nobody knows all this stuff. It said, but it assured me that I had the skills and talent and that I'd get the inner help, meaning the intuitional guidance, and the outer help, meaning experts and books and resource materials, that I'd be able to do this if I took the project on. Well, it took me a year to persuade myself that A, it was a good idea, and that B, maybe I could actually do it. And then another year to write the book proposal and sample chapters. Now, I'll give you, you know, while I'm writing this proposal, and it's not like I'm hearing voices on a regular occasion. Like, you know, a year has gone by and I haven't heard anything, though I'm kind of ticking away at it. So I'm working on the proposal and I'm working on the chapters I'm comfortable with, like the engineering chapter, or, you know, like the renewable energy chapter. I mean, I've been into renewable energy since the late 70s and I'm an engineer, so that's a no-brainer. The water chapter, I design water filters and backcountry filters and medical filters. So it's an area that I'm a genuine expert in, a bona fide expert. And the alternative healing, I've been into that since the late 70s also. So I'm focusing on these chapters, and now the voice comes in and says, you got to focus on the future of the world chapter. It's chapter 2 called Present, Trans, Possible Futures. And it's like, oh, okay, okay. So I start reading all of the world's best eco writings. And what I find, and here I thought of myself as kind of Mr. Eco, I mean, that I'm, you know, pretty ecologically aware. And while I'm reading this, while I'm studying all of this material, the best scientific writings on the trends in the world, the ecological trends, I realized that our world is far closer to systemic collapse than I had thought. Here I thought I was pretty aware. Now realize that this is 1997. 1997.com was booming. No one had heard, no one that I knew of had heard of Y2K. Not that I ever thought Y2K was going to do anything anyways. The second intifada in the Middle East hadn't started yet. It looked like the peace process was going to resolve peacefully and everything's going to be fine. Oil was at a 30-year low when you factored inflation in. And here I get this kind of semi-apocalyptic project dumped in my lap. Now the voice comes in again and says, millions of people will be needing this information in the not too distant future. And, you know, I'm thinking like, why me? It's like, why didn't you give me a book like, you know, How to Think Positive and Manifest Millions of Dollars? And it's like, no, somebody else got that project. That's not yours. So I get the end of the world. Anyway, it was, I must admit, at first it was a bummer. But that there's kind of like stages of denial when people are dealing with cancer. You know, first there's denial, and then it's like, why me? And then there's acceptance, and then there's maybe empowerment that I can actually do something about it. And I must admit, getting this book project was a lot like that. It was kind of like, why me? And, you know, this is really a bummer. But then it's like, maybe in one hand, I can help people on the practical point of view deal with these changes, deal with preparing for them, learning the skills, doing their best to manage them. And on the other hand, I can also help empower people to wake up and maybe change it so the outcome in our future won't be so bad. Maybe we can make a sustainable world. I mean, right now, every year we're going closer and closer to collapse. But if we make true, bona fide, real change in the way we do business in our world, I believe we can avoid collapse. Now, humans are social animals. You take a look at the person next to you, look them in the eyes. In most disasters, it brings out the best in most people. People reach out their hands and they extend them to their neighbor, and it brings out the best in people. So perhaps this stuff's all happening on the planet so that we'll rise out of our selfish selves and that we'll learn to think more about our friends and neighbors and the planet than we do about being super rich or whatever. Or whatever Britney Spears is doing this week. You know, I mean, that's real important. So anyway, most of us do better in groups than alone. Community allows us to pool skills and resources. And there is definitely a strength in numbers. You know, in the medieval times, they had castles and communities because people, it was, you know, there wasn't much law and order. And the lone wolf would get picked off by some thief or some marauder. So it was in community, in their local castles, their local communities, that people had strength and protection. In Europe, they have community-based renewable energy co-ops where people invest together and they put together wind farms. And when you have that kind of local energy generation, then your local grid will be much more stable and much more able to survive, you know, large grid meltdowns. If you have that local distributed energy generation capabilities, then if the grid does really melt down, then the local guys will be able to go out and disconnect from the main grid and maintain at least some level of services locally. Now, coping with a changing world. Darwin says, it's not the strongest of the species that survives, nor the most intelligent, but the one most responsive to change. So back onto this car insurance thing. You know, we all have car insurance, but none of us plans on getting into a head-on collision when we drive down the freeway. So emergency preparedness, self-reliance skills, these kinds of things are like an insurance policy. There's something that you hope you're never going to need, but it certainly doesn't hurt developing these skills and investing a small amount in some of the emergency preparedness items so that you're not stuck like the people in Hurricane Katrina or Kobe, Japan. a few skills and preparations and planning can bring you great peace of mind. Now, here's something. This might be the most important thing I talk about today, and I call it the intuitive edge. Now, countless survival stories, people will interview a survivor of some situation, and they'll say, well, how did you survive? And often it'll be, well, you know, often they'll say, I wish I had only listened to this voice of intuition that could have prevented me from being in this horrible situation to begin with, because there was something telling them, like, don't go on that trip, or, you know, don't go out here. And it's not fear. And I'll tell you how to distinguish between fear and true intuition in a minute. And that, or maybe, but then they'll often say, but then, you know, like, I got into this horrible situation. It was life and death. And something inside of me just snapped, and it told me what to do, and it knew exactly what to go. And see, millions of years of natural selection in nature has bred into each and every one of us the most incredible survival mechanism. And it is called your intuition. And it's an inner compass that simply knows what to do, knows what direction to turn. Now, those people that didn't have it in our past, you know, our ancestors that didn't have it, they all died. Some situation came up and they died. So natural selection of nature meant that the people that didn't have it died. So it's bred into each and every one of us. The problem is that our modern society focuses on the left brain rational thought, and it tends to poo-poo the intuition. And yet, when you talk to, like, really successful super investors or whatever, they'll often say they have this gut feel that guides them in their business decisions. So, in fact, Albert Einstein said that the true gift is the intuition, and the rational mind should be the servant of the intuition, and that Western society has gotten it all wrong. He said that all of his true genius came through intuitional flashes, and that he spent the rest of his life trying to use the rational mind in equations to describe what came to him intuitionally. How can you tell if it's the rational mind, if it's fear, or if it's intuition? Well, when it's intuition, it tends to be quiet. Not always, but it's usually quiet, and it's unwavering. See, now the rational mind is only as good as the information base it has to draw upon, and that's always imperfect at best. And often in a crisis situation, it's just totally gone. You have no information. The cell phones are down, the TV's down, the radio's down. You know, you don't know where to go, what to turn. Maybe there's smoke all around, and you just don't know what to do. So the rational mind, if it's the rational mind or fear speaking, it will change its mind every few minutes. And if you find yourself thinking, like, oh, I should do this, and then 2 minutes later, maybe I should do that, and 2 minutes later, no, I should do that, then you know you can't trust it, because you don't have the information, and it's either fear talking or it's your left brain talking, and it doesn't have the information to figure it out. So now here's an exercise for helping you to bypass that and figure out what you should do. And I suggest you practice this. It's called practice this on non-critical things. I call it the pit of the stomach exercise. And it's in my book, and it's also on my website for free. So, you know, you don't have to take notes now if you don't want to. But so I'll use the example of a guy. A couple years back, there was a high-tech guy from San Francisco with his wife and child somewhere in the backwoods of Oregon. You're probably familiar with the story. He was driving around. I think he was trying to take a shortcut. He got lost. He disoriented, backwoods, back roads, ran out of gas, out of cell phone range, spent 2 days with his wife in his car, finally said, you know, I mean, he had an infant in the car. He said, you know, I got to try. I can't just leave you here to die. I'm gonna try. Rational mind says, the rule of survival is you follow the river and it'll take you to civilization. So he did the rule. Now I'll tell you about the pit of the stomach and what he should have done. Pit of the stomach says you're not sure. You don't know what to do. So you want to bypass the fear. You want to bypass the left brain. You want to get in touch with this intuitive inner compass that knows. So the intuitive mind thinks in pictures. Einstein received relativity in pictures. He saw it. I received my book in pictures. I saw it in the mind's eye. It's pictures and feelings. It's not talking. So, pit of the stomach. Take a few deep breaths. Keep feeling this part of your stomach between your belly button and your rib cage. until you can feel the muscles relax. Close your eyes. If you're religious, offer a prayer, Jesus, Buddha, Muhammad, Holy Spirit, whatever. Keep breathing until it's relaxed. You feel a relaxed, expanded feeling in the pit of your stomach. It may take a while if you're freaking out and you're in a tough situation. Then think in pictures. Make a picture. So in this case of the guy in Oregon, picture yourself walking down the river. Feel the pit of the stomach. If you feel it tighten up into a knot, bad choice. If you feel a queasy, sick feeling in your stomach, bad choice. So then start breathing again. Relax, breathe. Make a picture of option number two. Maybe it's following the ridge where someone might see you in a helicopter search plane. Okay, picture option number two. After you've relaxed, feel it again. If you feel that bad feeling in the stomach, the clench or the sick feeling, queasy feeling, bad decision. Maybe option number three. Maybe I stay in the car with my wife. Now the mind says, no, I gotta act. You know, it's flight or flight. Adrenaline says act, run, do this, do something, okay? But in this guy's case, it turned out that the wife was rescued because they tracked the cell phone records by the tower when he didn't show up. They figured out what part of the country he was in. They launched a search, and they found the wife by driving all the back roads and somebody found the car, and the wife and kid were saved. The guy falling in the river, he got exhausted, he got wet, he died of exposure before he was able to get to civilization. So the pit of the stomach, then you picture that last thing, staying in the car. Maybe you get that ah feeling, that expanded, relaxed feeling. This is important. In the World Trade Center, interviews with some of the survivors said that they just knew, like one guy just knew he was at his place and he had to run to this corner. The voice in him screamed at him and he had to run to that corner. He ran to that corner, everything collapsed in the buildings around him. That corner was a little space like in the bottom floor that the structure survived around it and kept a little airspace around him. I was working on a patent case as an expert witness in Vegas right before Christmas. And I had this conversation with a Vietnam vet. And, you know, we were on kind of opposite ends of the political spectrum. And so I sort of steered, it's like, okay, this conversation's going nowhere. So I sort of steered the conversation, asked him about his life. He started telling me about Vietnam. He's a 19-year-old kid in Vietnam. He's been there 3 weeks. He's in the infantry. And this guy just, you could see him just go. He's all of a sudden, here he is. He's older, a few years older than me, you know, white-haired, kind of walking with a limp. And you just see him, he's back in Vietnam, and he's walking in the jungle, this 19-year-old kid. The guys in front of him stop for a cigarette break and let themselves get lost from and separated from their troop. And all of a sudden, they're lost. So he's just following these guys who seem to know better because he's only been there 3 weeks, and these guys are seasoned guys. And he's following them, and they go out, and he says, well, we'll go, this big black guy says, we'll go this way, and they go that way. And they're going out in the meadow, and then machine guns open up, and the guy in front of him gets, you know, shot up, and he puts him on his shoulder, and he's running, and he's bleeding all over him, but he's still alive, and they're freaking out, not knowing what to do, and they, you know, getting back, and they're like, oh, man, you know, and I know what to do, and they're freaking out. And the guy who kind of led them that way in the first place says, well, we're going down this way, you know, and trust me, I know, because I'm here. So he turns and follows him. His internal alarm goes, you're going to die. And he says, no, we're going this way. And as soon as he turns around, that internal alarm goes, And the other guys say, well, this guy seems to know what he's doing. I think we'll follow him because everyone's freaking out. Nobody knows what he's doing. It turned out that they had stumbled into a maze of tunnels in a war school for the Viet Cong. And there was like 1,000 troops in that valley. And his internal alarm guided him at every moment. Every time he started doing a direction where they were going to run into people, his alarm went off, and then he would tell them to hide or do this or do that. And, you know, they'd move off the trail, and then hear like 20 guys go by. And so this works. It's in each and every one of us. This works. Now, first aid and self-healing, I encourage every adult to take advanced first aid and CPR training. I've used it a number of times in my life, and it's come in very helpful. And I think, you know, you guys live in earthquake country. Hopefully it'll never happen. But, you know, massive traumatic injuries. When Kobe, Japan came down, the hospitals were overloaded. Most of the doctors, most of the public servants were just in the same boat as everybody else. Nothing was working. It was 9 days before a lot of people got relief. You know, you really want to know some of these skills, have some of these materials on hand. I have free articles on the website. I have great lists and information in the book. And the great thing about the book and preparedness is that it's not like paranoia is required. So what you can do is it gives you different levels of readiness. So maybe one day you want to have a grab and run kit so you can handle a minor meltdown. Things are down for 3 or 4 days, you know, minor medical emergencies, etc. But then maybe that day will come when things are really falling apart and your intuitional alarm is saying, you got to go out and you got to buy 6 months of food or a year of food. I don't have that on hand now. I got a good month's worth of food. I got a great grab and run kit, plenty of backcountry gear. But I don't have, you know, 5 years of food stored up or anything. But that day may come where that internal alarm says, you've got to go and you've got to go now before it's all gone. And if I've got my book on hand, I can at least pull it down off the shelf. And it's, you know, it's a big, fat, thick, 3 years of my life in here. And all the equity in my home, or more than all the equity in my home in this book. That day may come where I pull my own book off the shelf and say, I'm opening to the work page and I'm writing this down and I'm going to Costco or wherever I can buy what's left before it's all gone. And I've got the worksheets and I fill them out and do that. So your level of preparedness today may be totally different from 6 months or a year or 2 years from now. But having the information, you know, knowledge is power. You want to start developing some of these skills and talents now while the world is still working reasonably well. While you still have some money that you can devote a little bit to buying a few of these things, a good backcountry filter, a colloidal silver generator. You know, these are real things that can really help you out today and could be a lifesaver in a situation. So I encourage you to get some of this information and start practicing some of these things now. Just another little story here. Factory farms are making our animals into factories for growing antibiotic-resistant superbugs. So this is a real issue. And if you are relying on pharmaceuticals to heal you, you may be SOL. You know, you may be just totally out of luck one of these days. Because in a huge event, the pharmaceuticals just won't be available. And also, there are many bugs out there now that pharmaceuticals do not work for, but there are alternative, low-cost alternative medicines and herbs and homeopathy that can be extremely effective, far more effective than the best pharmaceutical out there. So I encourage you to open your eyes, and I have a whole chapter devoted to this. And, you know, I believe in the shotgun effect, and I'm an engineer. One of my friends who's an engineer had a great saying. He said, it's got to work. You know, I design stuff that's got to work. Well, when it comes to medicine, I don't care about, you know, studies and FDA approvals as much as I care about it working. To give you an example, about 10 years ago, my wife had an antibiotic-resistant urinary infection. It was written up in the San Francisco Chronicle that it was plaguing women all across the country that summer, and they were having problems because antibiotics wasn't working very well on it. So we went to the doctor, and he gave her, first prescribed the antibiotic that, you know, they always prescribe for women with that sort of thing. That didn't work. Then he went to another one. That didn't work. And then he went to Cipro, which is like a last defense, super expensive, very toxic, you know, antibiotic. Well, after a week of Cipro, it would be under control. 3 days after she came off Cipro, it came back. Went back on Cipro. Seemed to work. 3 days after she got off Cipro, went back. Back on Cipro again. Didn't work. You know, 3 days it came back. So after $2,000 and several months of antibiotics that were wrecking the balance in her body and really taxing her liver and her kidneys because of the toxicity of the antibiotics, we used homemade colloidal silver, roughly 10 cents a day's worth, about a quart a day, and 15 drops of grapefruit seed extract mixed in some juice from the health food store. That's about a $10 bottle from the health food store. So what, we spent like $15 and in a week it was gone. The infection was gone, not a problem. Another example, guy I met happens to be another MIT guy, about 10 years older than me, had a silver mine, in stockholder silver mine in Utah. His wife goes into the hospital, comes out with a flesh-eating bacteria. They're contemplating amputating her leg because no antibiotics are working to try and save her life. So what, he says, wait a minute, I've been reading about this silver stuff. I got a silver mine, so I'm going to go out and get some colloidal silver and try it. It kicks the antibiotic-resistant infection. 2 months ago, Miss Brazil, beautiful woman, one of the top five finalists in the Miss World pageant. She gets an antibiotic-resistant infection, goes into the hospital, pump her full of antibiotics. Money is not an issue. She's, you know, she's like a superstar. Money is not the problem. They amputate her hands and her feet trying to save her life. She dies anyway. For $10, you know, for a few dollars worth of colloidal silver, almost certainly would have killed the infection and she would be alive today. So I'm not anti-medicine, but I'm saying open your eyes, be aware, be open to these possibilities. Solutions, community-based energy co-ops, develop self-reliant skills, strong community. Buy and grow local. You know, whenever you buy local, you're supporting the local business people. It's keeping the dollars circulating in your community. We've been shipping, last year when oil was $140 a barrel, we were shipping $2 billion a day of American dollars out of our country, gone permanently, to buy foreign oil and to pay for military expenses to protect our oil supply in offshore places. Think if we'd been spending that kind of money on rebuilding America as a renewable, sustainable society. That money would be staying in our country and circulating around and around and around, and our economy would not be in the shape it's in today. We need to develop low-tech skills and tools and markets. Individually and collectively, you're a very aware community here in Portland. So starting to develop those skills locally, the ability to survive peak oil, the ability to survive collapse, you want to develop that the abilities, the skills locally. Develop that networking locally. Back up off-grid renewable energy systems. They're not cheap, but they're coming down. The next generation of solar panels is already in pilot production right now. Germany took what Jimmy Carter did in the 1970s, made America the leader for the next 20 years in renewable energy all around the world. Even though it was dismantled by Ronald Reagan and it caused many of those businesses to collapse that were built up then, we still had enough momentum going from those 4 years of Jimmy Carter to make us the number one in the world. Well, Germany took our lead, and Japan and other, in Spain and other countries took our lead and took it a big step forward. They put in feed-in tariffs in Germany. In between 2002 and 2006, they more than doubled the amount of renewable energy that was the percentage of renewable energy in the energy infrastructure in Germany. They did in 4 years' time what the Bush administration said we couldn't do in 25 years, and they did it in 4 years' time. We can do this. Grab and run kits for short-term survival. Now, here's one more anecdote I'm going to share with you, and then we'll open it up for some questions. This story was told to me by a teacher of survival classes in Arizona. And he says, they teach this survival class, kind of living off the land. At the end of the classes, then they do, not really a solo, but they basically have 3 days where they have to eat and fend for themselves out in the woods. And he says almost always they split into two groups, just naturally. The men split into one group, the women is split into one group. The men focus on hunting and fishing, and the women focus on gathering fruits and berries and edible roots. He says come day three, the starving men hungrily come over to the women and beg to share some of the food that the women have gathered. Because it turns out that with those low-tech tools, you know, the old spears and the things that you can cobble together from nature without having their guns and their modern fish hooks and fishing gear, that the men aren't doing very well. And I'll relate one other story. As a child growing up hunting in Vermont and fishing, everyone wanted to go hunting on the first day, or at least the first week of hunting season. Because the first day, man, the game was all over the place. By the end of the first week, it was already getting pretty sparse. And by the end of the first month of hunting season, it's like the game that was still there was smart enough that they know to make themselves pretty much invisible. So now imagine if every day of the year is hunting season, and instead of one out of 50 people out there hunting, you've got 50 out of 50 people out there hunting. Everything that is edible, that walks and swims and is not invisible, is gone. So if you know how to grow food, that takes time, and how to forage for food, that doesn't take much time, but it takes knowledge, or how to do the plant edibility test, you're going to be miles ahead of most of the rest of the people. Opportunity. With collapse comes the opportunity to rebuild America. We can remake our world to be the kind of world we want it to be the world that cares about each other, that cares about sustainability, that cares about the planet. See, we could say right now, instead of propping up the paper chase in America, that we're going to use our dollars to put Americans back to work doing things that count, building things that count, building things that make a difference. Make America a country instead of a paper shuffling country that does paper dolls and lots of money and smoke and mirrors things. We need to rebuild America as a country that actually makes things of value again. Can we do this? Yes, we can. I believe we can. Are we doing this now? No. I mean, I think Obama's trying to make a start, but we're not doing it now. Can we do it? I believe we can. We beat Hitler in World War II. We took all of our manufacturing might in 6 months' time and transformed it to supporting the war effort. If we did that, we can do this. I believe, here's my motto. I know we're about out of time, but it'll give us about 10 minutes for questions. So I just skipped through the last few slides. My motto is to do your best to change the world and do your best to be ready for the changes in the world. And thank you very much. And if you have any questions, I'll be happy to answer your questions. Yes?
Not a question, but a comment. One thing that I encountered in central Vermont in the 90s is that people were using charged batteries as a means of power.
Well, certainly having solar charges and batteries and, you know, all kinds of goods. I mean, think about the simple little things every day that are often cheap that you take for granted, like toilet paper, Bic lighters. I mean, have you ever tried to go out and start a fire with a flint and steel? And have you ever tried to start a fire with a drill? And especially if the wood's not bone dry, you'll never make it. You know, the old-fashioned way with, I show you how in my book, it's doable, but it's really hard and really frustrating. So all those little things we take for granted in our society, you know, if it comes down to barter or collapse, having a little supply of often those things are very cheap. You can go down to Costco today and buy them for like nothing. You know, those are really handy things to have. Any more questions or comments? Yes. It's in my book in the survival chapter. I have a food chapter and a survival chapter. I'll give it to you in a nutshell, but you might want to read it and study it because it could come in very handy. The main thing is not going too fast. Because most of us, if you're in a survival situation, you won't happen to have an edible plant encyclopedia in your back pocket. Now, I encourage you all to go out and get one, but you know, in case you don't have one, or you're not sure if that edible plant in the book is really the one you're going to eat, then first you start out, you take some of the plant leaves and you crush them and you smell them. And if they smell like almonds or peaches, then that's a very common plant poison called like cyanic acid. It's kind of like cyanide. Don't eat it. Then the next thing you do is you take that plant and you take some of the juice of the crushed part and you rub it like in the inside of your elbow or your thigh, and then you wait like 15, 20 minutes. If you feel any itching, burning, or irritation or stinging, don't eat it. Then the next thing you do, and as you get to each step, you're going to have to go slower and give yourself more time between the steps. Because if you go too fast, you might well die. Don't do this with mushrooms. Mushrooms, by the time you know, you might be terminally poisoned. So just, if you don't know the mushroom, don't do the mushroom, period. And some things that animals will eat, people can't eat. There's certain animals that can eat. So just because a bird eat it or a frog ate it doesn't mean you can eat it, okay? So the next step is you take some of that and you squeeze the juice and you put it on your lips. And you look for a reaction like swelling or burning in your lips and wait another 15 minutes. The next step is you take a pea-sized piece of it and you chew it and you hold it in like under your tongue for about 10 minutes. Then you spit it out. Don't swallow it at this point. wait like another half hour. So after you've done this, and this is fairly quick, this part of the test, then you take like a teaspoon, and this can you can do the first part of the test in a couple hours. The next one, though, you take like a teaspoon-sized piece of it. Or well, you take like a pea-sized piece of it, and you eat that, and you wait a couple of hours. And then you take a teaspoon-sized piece, and you eat that, and you wait overnight. So the first, basically, you've taken up the first day on the edibility test before you've actually eaten a chunk. And you wait at 24 hours, and you see if you get sick. And then after that, if you're not sick, you can assume you can eat it. Yes? Okay, good. Jeremy says that it does burn, so you'll have figured that out already. And yes, the hemlock also looks like wild carrot tops, I've heard, when it's young. And in fact, Carla Emery, in her wonderful book called The Encyclopedia of Country Living, and I miss Carla, you know, she croaked last year, but she's a wonderful person, wonderful book. She told a story of some plant expert, edibility expert, self-proclaimed, telling some couple or some group of families, oh, this is wild celery, and this is great, and you can eat it. And it was hemlock, and they ate it. And Carla happened to see them, and they said, oh, you know, here, you want some? And she's, that's hemlock. You know, it's poisonous. And rushed them to the hospital and showed some of it to a ranger. And he verified, oh, yes, that is hemlock. And if they hadn't pumped their stomachs right then they would have all died. The whole family would have died. So this is serious, and that's why you must go extremely slow with the plant edibility test. And thank you for sharing that it will burn. That's good to know that. And people ask me, I mean, what are the best bugs to eat? You know, and it's like if it's good enough for your local bear or good enough for the robin, it's good enough for you. And then they all, you know, so it's like worms, earthworms, you can split their bellies open and take the dirt out because they eat dirt. If they're snails or slugs, if they're brightly colored insects and snails are always suspect, like don't eat them. Brightly colored is usually a warning sign that says, I'm brightly colored. That means I'm going to make you sick or kill you if you eat me. And also plants that, other than dandelions, which are very nutritious, plants that have milky sap, don't eat them. If they're milky sap, like milkweed, they're poisonous. You know, just a few little tips there. People always ask me, what bugs have I eaten? And it's like, well, I've fasted for 10 days and then done a 10-mile run after a 10-day fast. So I've never gotten to the point where I had to eat the local salamander or the local maggots or the local grasshoppers. Grasshoppers are supposed to be pretty good, to be honest with you. I've heard they're pretty good. They eat them in Africa on a regular basis. Pick the heads off, take the wings and legs off. They got nasty little sharp barbs. It'll wreak havoc with your throat if you eat those parts. If you can roast them, it's always better. If you can roast grubby maggoty things, you know, on a hot rock or in the sun, that's always better because they might have parasites. They might have nasty bugs that'll make you sick, especially if they've been eating yucky, rotten things. So, you know, nobody's paid me enough money to go out and eat a spoonful of maggots yet. So, you know, I haven't done that one. And hopefully I never will. The last chapter of my book, which is first published in 2000, and I just finished the second edition, which is 35% larger, and I included the last chapter called Making the Shift to Sustainability. And it is about, and it's a 12-point plan for making sustainability and throughout the planet. And a good part of it is, we're all in this together. If we take this planet down, it's like whether you're in first class or third class on the Titanic, you know, it's going down. And good planets are hard to come by. And so the whole last chapter is devoted to making the shift to sustainability, and not just in America, but in the whole planet as a whole. And I believe it's doable, but it's not easy. And I also believe that business as usual will collapse the plant, the natural systems of the planet, and will take it down without question in my mind. Because there's about 5 trends now, which as a scientist and engineer, any one of those trends is a civilization buster that will take the planet down. And business as usual will keep those trends. There's a definition of insanity saying, insanity is doing the same thing over and over again and expecting a different result. And I sometimes say, well, no, that's human nature. But it means that real change and not just lip service change, not just tiny changes, must happen if we're going to stop the train wreck of collapse. And right now we're headed for a train wreck of collapse. Are you talking about the book Sol Viva on Martha's Vineyard? There's a really good book. And each of my chapters ends in a resource guide. And in Martha's Vineyard, there's a lady that sells high-quality organic produce to the restaurants in Boston. And she can grow in the middle of winter in her solar-heated, you know, greenhouse. And she heats it with a couple of rolled newspapers in her wood stove is all she needs in the middle of winter in Martha's Vineyard to keep everything going. So there are solutions, I believe, and a lot of my book is about those solutions on a personal, community, and a global level. And, you know, one of the encouraging things is a really inspiring book called Blessed Unrest by Paul Hawkins. And it turns out that there's something like 2 million independent organizations right now that have sprung up around the world dedicated to ecological, environmental, and social change and transforming the planet. And I think what it is that there's a consciousness on the planet that we're in trouble, that the organism is extremely sick and is terminally ill, and that we have to do something. And so independently, all over the planet, people are waking up and saying we're going to do it. And my hope is that we will take control over and take power and take our power back from the governments and make the governments do the right thing. See, and the governments generally don't lead, they follow. Lincoln did not single-handedly end slavery. It took millions of people to put someone in power who finally did the slavery thing. Millions of people said slavery is an evil that must be destroyed, and the suffrage, that movement right there, you know, put them in power and it made it happen. Millions of people decided women needed the vote and needed to have equal rights with men and made it happen. And there's 2 million organizations in the world now saying our planet is sick and must be healed. So I believe there's hope with numbers like that. Here's my webmaster, and he's saying on the website, we have, you can click on the references. And even if you don't have my book, the recommended references with videos, green building videos, and I have many reviews on each of those. So it's totally free. You can go to the website, click on the different books, read the mini reviews, and it'll tell you what to get.